Hello and welcome to Everyone's an Expert with me, Alex D. Today, my guest is journalist and broadcaster Sam Delaney. Sam's worked in a myriad of roles in the media. He's been editor-in-chief of some of the UK's biggest magazines, writes often for The Guardian and other broadsheets, and also writes a lot at the moment for The Big Issue. He's presented on 5 Live and TalkSport, and was the host of the now permanently rested TV show Sam Delaney's News Thing, amongst many other jobs. In recent years, Sam's been a somewhat prolific podcaster, and I came to know him through his work on the football-adjacent podcast Top Flight Time Machine, which he does with fellow writer Andy Dawson, and his own podcast, The Reset. We talk about both of these in our chat. Sam's a hilarious anecdotalist and has a way of discussing pop culture in particular that I find really compelling. Essentially, I've become a great admirer of his over the last couple of years, so I was delighted when he agreed to join me. We have a chat about music's power to evoke nostalgia, using pop as a jumping-off point for discussing culture in general, and because we recorded this back in February, there's a healthy portion of Get Back Chat too. Sam, welcome to Everyone's an Expert. Thanks for coming on, mate. It's great to speak
to you. Absolute pleasure to be here, Alex. Thank you for inviting me.
So I know you primarily from your work with Top Flight Time Machine, the Sometimes Football podcast. Formerly football podcast, maybe, I don't know.
We say it used to be a football podcast because that's what we started it as, and it sort of evolved into something much broader. But I personally think that the spirit of it is still the spirit of the football fan.
Yeah.
I think that sort of probably, even though we don't often talk about football, certainly not as much as we used to, I think that the sort of, we brought together an audience of people who were like-minded, and the starting point for that was that they all had grown up being into football. And I can't quite explain what that means.
Yeah. Were you guys surprised at the kind of community that seems to have formed around it?
Oh, yeah, massively. Yeah, absolutely. I've worked in the media my whole career, and I've been associated with some, kind of quite large mainstream sort of media brands and that have big audiences. But I have never seen a community like the one we've got around Top Flight Time Machine. It's really touching because it's the most personal thing I've ever done. But it, in terms of the commitment, its audience in comparison to some things I've done is much, much smaller. But the intensity of the engagement and the sense of community that was that sprung up from quite an early stage is, it amazes me. It blows me away whenever I think about it. And I'm genuinely really touched by it. And it's like, we get messages from people saying, oh, thanks for the content. It got me through a hard time, particularly in lockdown stuff. But that works both ways, because actually not necessarily the praise, although that's nice, but just the way in which people embrace the sort of ideas and the spirit of it, when you see that expressed either through their communications directly with us or sort of almost more touchingly when you see listeners discussing things that came up on the pod but with each other separately on Facebook or on Twitter or whatever, that is amazing. And we all have ups and downs. And I can tell you, during any down points I have, for whatever reason, when you're having a miserable day, shit like that really makes you feel part of something special. So it's like a small little thing that the vast majority of people haven't heard of, but those who are involved in it, it sort of seems to mean a lot. And it means a huge amount to me. And I know it does to Andy as well.
Oh, that's brilliant. And I mean, I not to do that typical thing of starting off a chat with the smoke blowing, but I'm definitely someone that's kind of part of that. I think from about, I'm not an early adopter, but sort of mid 2019, and been a huge fan.
Right, yeah.
And in terms of the remit of this particular podcast, what the main reason I wanted to chat to you is when you guys started doing the semi-regular historical chart deep dives.
Yeah.
I just think that thing that you talk about with having that sort of audience that has football in common, but will kind of let you go to other places. I love the way that you guys approach chatting about pop music, center it in pop culture. And I don't know, I think those episodes are kind of really, really alive. And it strikes me that you guys really enjoy doing them and getting into them.
I really like them. I mean, we do so many episodes now and all different categories of episodes. Like we do deep dives into books, or sometimes we do these history box things where we choose kind of strange sort of ephemeral concepts to examine. And some days, you know, you look forward to different ones, depending on your mood that day, but also depending on what you've got on the go. But the Top Flight Tune Machine, which I think is every second Sunday, I think that's what it is, when we put it out. When we've got one of those to record, I always really look forward to it. I'm always really excited because pop music, obviously, pop music means a great deal to me and Andy. But I just think it's just not just the music itself, but it's a jumping off point for pretty much everything else that we get, that we feel passionately about, and that seems to engage our audience, because so much of our show is about childhood nostalgia. And then that brings in sort of personal anecdotes, which, of course, I'm a fan of telling. But also just everything else that was going on around that time, or the individuals or the songs involved. There's like a million branches. It's sort of almost, I'm glad you said you're a big fan, because I never know, really. It's only some subscribers get it, I think. But I sort of think it's almost peak Top Flight Time Machine fodder, the pop music stuff, because it's such a natural starting point for all the other kind of conversations that we love to have.
Yeah, that's certainly how it strikes me. And from my perspective as someone who, in with one of my hats, kind of studies pop music, quote unquote, academically, which is kind of a contentious thing in itself, It strikes me that what you guys are doing is actually closer to the heart of pop's sort of real meaning and real importance. Is that thing, how it brings people together, the memories thing? Not to go too deep about it. I mean, you're someone who seems to have a pretty phenomenal memory for various different things that have happened, you know, in your life or you know, around that. But it's a strong spark for nostalgia, isn't it, music?
It's the biggest. It's definitely the biggest. Music is the biggest sort of catalyst for really vivid and emotional nostalgic recall. And that's probably why some of the best stuff from my own memory will come out during those episodes. And just every day, I mean, it's just like, I do like new music, and I do try to listen to new music. I listen to the radio every day, but, you know, music from your past, particularly pop music, is just like, it's the most powerful thing. It's the closest you can get to time travel. It really is the closest you can get to time travel when you hear a song, especially when, if you haven't heard it for a while, it's the closest you'll ever get to being really quite vividly transported back to a time and place. And on the whole, that's really positive as well. Maybe I was lucky to have like a sort of relatively happy childhood, because if I hear any sort of 80s pop songs that remind me of different moments in my childhood, more often than not, it just puts a huge smile on my face, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's quite interesting how you can sort of do that deliberately. I don't know if you ever do that. I'll sometimes find myself curating playlists to sort of get to that place.
I do that a lot. Yeah, I do that in different seasons of the year. I'll be walking along and obviously the weather and nature is quite a big nostalgic cue. And so sometimes I'll be walking along like yesterday, and actually today here where I am in London, it's a very sort of, there's quite a lot of bright sunshine. It feels almost, although we're still on the first day of February, like early spring. And for some reason, that is really evocative of school days to me. I don't know why. I think very often around that time, school felt like fun when the sun started shining again.
Yeah.
And then very quickly, I will think of a song that is, you know, and I don't know. It's very often from around like the early 90s, right? I don't know why this is the case, but like spring, a sunny spring day will remind me of when I was about 15 or 16, going in and out of school and being really happy with the world and with life and with everything that was going on. And all the songs that I would have had on my Walkman at that time, and that would have been on the radio at that time. And then I'll often go home and listen to all of those, because it'll, and that's the way the process can work. First, it's this weather, then that triggers a memory. I've no idea why spring is specifically linked. Although what was going on specifically in the Easter of 1990 or 1991, but a bit of sort of like cold, bright sunshine, and I'll be back. I'll be whacking on De La Soul as soon as I get in, basically.
Yeah, right. I've been finding for me recently, I'm a little bit younger, but I've been deliberately on this kind of mid-90s nostalgia trip. And it's not quite the same as what you're talking about, because it's kind of some music that I guess I was barely conscious of. But for some reason, I just seem to be really into that era and kind of deliberately trying to evoke a feeling of nostalgia.
I think there's stuff from your childhood that it was in the background that you weren't necessarily into, in as much as you didn't know who it was by, and you weren't necessarily even, you know, expressing a huge enthusiasm for it when you were a very young kid. But then you hear it again when you're older, and somehow it's embedded in your soul in some way, and it means something really powerful to you that you didn't realize at the time, you know.
Like
my dad that's exactly what it is. It's a Proustian Russian. My dad used to come and get me at the weekend sometimes and take me out. And he used to often have like rock and roll tapes in the car, like rock and roll compilations, which he had been into, you know, since he was a teenager in the 1950s. He was growing up and was the first generation to be very into and he used to, you know, he's a fanatic and bought rock and roll records from America. But like, I think by the late 70s, early 80s, there was a bit of a rock and roll revival going on.
Yeah, sure.
Amongst teenagers. And there was like films like That'll Be the Day and stuff like that. And there was certain bands who were aping it. And suddenly in the late 70s, early 80s, it came back. And so there was that must have been why there was a lot of compilations. And my dad had like, you know, Golden Greats or something in the car. And it had all stuff like That'll Be the Day or whatever, or Eddie Cochran. And I think he just used to play that nonstop. And I would have been way too young. I mean, we're talking like 5 years old to sort of have understood that if it was old music or new music or what the fuck it was. But now, whenever I hear that old rock and roll, oh my God, yeah, the Proustian Rush is very intense. And I still love that music as well.
I really love that thing of the music from childhood that you love completely unobjectively. It's got nothing to do with the other stuff. When you're a teenager, it's part of your identity forming, isn't it?
But
you're very deliberate what you choose to like, and the genre is important. But that thing from your childhood, are you conscious of that
more
with your
pure
kids?
Isn't it? I think I am, because like we're really, you know, one of the things that my wife and I have in common and share, and have always sort of, you know, kind of been part of our relationship, has been music. You know, we generally love the same music. My wife probably has, you know, has more knowledge and passion for it than I do. And certainly, you know, she's sort of a lot of, you know, she's got very good music taste, I think. And, you know, so educated me a lot about music. But as a result, like, the kids have grown up around music being played the whole time. Although it's quite funny with our kids, because it's a bit like an Absolutely Fabulous scenario, because they often complain to us about us playing music too loud. They don't like it in the car. They complain about certain types of music that we play. But, you know, there is music, particularly my son, he makes playlists, and it's kind of really sweet and lovely that a lot of the playlist is sort of a strange and improbable kind of mishmash of stuff that he's just grown up and played in the background, you know. It's really nice. And I'm guessing that will come back to him in later life once he's gone on and developed his own prejudices, which my daughter, because she's much older, she's 14, she now has developed her own prejudices and what's cool and what isn't and all the rest of it. So she's past that point and is probably at the moment more into rejecting anything that we we used to play her when she was young. But she'll come back to it. There's no escape.
Yeah, you know it's in there now, yeah. One of the other things I've heard you mention a few times is love of rock star autobiographies. I just wonder, would you, for listeners, recommend any of your top favourites
Yeah, I don't know why I'm into them really. I think someone I haven't always been into them. It was only like, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 10 years ago at the most, someone said, one of my uncles said to me, you've got to read. He said, you've got to listen on audiobook to Rod Stewart's autobiography. And I was like, what the fuck are you on about? I've never really been much of a Rod Stewart fan. I don't mind him and like some of his songs, but I just thought it was a peculiar suggestion. He went, no, trust me, it's hilarious, right? So, and he said it's the audiobook that's so funny because he obviously couldn't be bothered doing it himself, right? A lot of these authors do it themselves.
Yeah.
Rod Stewart's thought, fuck that, right? Funnily enough, someone told me, a mate of mine told me yesterday that he's listening to Phil Collins's one, and Phil Collins did do it himself and apparently is really funny at doing it. But Rod Stewart has obviously thought, fuck that. So he's they've got an actor, but it's really weird because he got an actor who sounds nothing like Rod Stewart. He's really like, he's got a very actorly plummy sort of received English kind of, you know, very kind of theatrical delivery like this, right? But, and apparently, I don't know how my uncle knew this, but he told me, he goes, yeah, the thing is, the actor's his mate. So he's basically shoved the work his mate's way to earn his mate a bit of cash on the side. I don't know whether that's true, but it's really inappropriate because obviously Rod Stewart is, I believe, from North London. He's got, you know, very Cockney delivery, and it's a lot of it is written in dialect, right? So one of the things that you've probably heard me talk about before is like he says the secret to his success with women is that he had this opening line where sees the most beautiful girl in the bar, never hesitates, goes straight up to her and always opens with the line, hello, darling, what you got in your handbag, right? Which I just think is sort of strange and funny. Probably would count as toxic masculinity these days. But anyway, but the thing is, when you listen to the audiobook, the actor doing it, he does it, but in his poem, he always goes, I would always go to the most beautiful woman in the bar and walk up to her immediately and say, hello, darling, what you got in your handbag? And it just sounded really incongruous and hilarious, this plummy actor delivering all of his sort of like Cockney dialogue in this sort of inappropriate voice. So I listened to it almost just for the comic value of that. But, I got to, you know, I couldn't believe it. I'd always assumed that these sorts of books, especially by that kind of style, would be really bland and have nothing of note in them and just be like loads of boring anecdotes about, you know, hanging out with other rock stars, and it would all be very vanilla. And I was astonished when I heard it because, in fact, it was like extremely raw, warts and all insight to the, you know, insane, extraordinary life of a normal working class kid who sort of somehow became world famous overnight and became a multimillionaire and bought Rolls Royces for fun and dated supermodels, right? Really extraordinary stuff. Really honest, really brutal, complete warts and all. You can't believe how much a guy like that, who's pretty mainstream and establishment now, is giving away. And then something clicked in my head. I thought, these guys are nutters. They're like so rich that they've got nothing to lose anymore. They don't give a shit. And they're interested in their legacy. And I also think the publishing industry in recent years got less of the cheap kind of knock it out, get it ghostwritten, and more into let's try and make books that are autobiographies that are actually do have some kind of literary ambition to tell a story in an authentic and interesting way. And I think that's certainly the case with what I consider the best one, which is Elton John's one from a couple of years ago, which is just amazing. It's probably the best autobiography I've read. And I've read a lot in all different types of people, but it's so honest and so brutal. And you cannot believe that this bloke who's like a Sir Elton John and his mates with the Royals and seems in many ways so mainstream is being so brutally honest about his drug use, his addictions, his sex life, his insecurities, his mental illnesses. It's just incredible. And it's a real achievement. And I think that, it blew me away. So those are two great ones. Phil Collins is a hilarious one for different reasons. These are all artists that I've never been massively into the music of either, by the way. I mean, all three of them have output that I enjoy, but they wouldn't be amongst my, like, the artists that I love. An artist that I do love who did a great autobiography is Nile Rodgers. And that, again, to me is interesting as a sort of recovering addict myself. A lot of these books inevitably touch upon, you know, addiction and recovery. And that's really interesting. And his, as well as Elton John's, covers that in a very funny way. And I like the way that they write about themselves and the sort of outlandish things they got up to when they were addicts in a very funny, self-effacing way. They're not overly earnest about it. It's kind of like an admission. This was mad. And to be honest, at times it was fucking brilliant. But then it got really ugly and I had to deal with it. And I like that sort of tone. And Nile Rodgers' book is great for that stuff.
Have you come across the one by Steve Lukather from Toto?
No, I haven't. I haven't even heard of that.
It's called The Gospel According to Luke. I'll send you a link.
Right.
I couldn't recommend it highly enough for many of the same features. He's one of these guys. Obviously, right. Toto are a big band, and you'd kind of recognise the sound of his voice from some of the things he's done.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, he was like Eddie Van Halen on so right. many records. You know, he played on a load of Michael Jackson records and...
Right, yeah.
He was one of those LA session guys in the late 70s.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what Quincy Jones did on Thriller. He just assembled the ultimate sort of session musician supergroup, didn't he?
For
play on those tracks.
And he was kind of one of the guitarists that would get that call.
Yeah.
And his, I read his book, but apparently his reading of the audiobook is brilliant as well, because he's a very charismatic guy. And the same way that he kind of talks about all those things, addiction, excess, and then the fallout of that in a really huge... Yeah. It's not po-faced in any way, you know.
Yeah, that's it. And that's sort of inspired me in the stuff that I've done about mental health, is trying to communicate it in a way that is not po-faced or earnest, or even particularly, you know, not kind of self-indulgent either. Just like very straightforward, this is what happened. Not quite sure why it happened. This might be it. Like not offering loads of sort of absolute explanations or solutions either, because I think that's a naive thing to offer to other people. It's more like, this happened. Look, of course it was a laugh. Let's not pretend it wasn't. But it was ultimately horrible. And, you know, this is how I've tried to recover. Being sort of quite matter of fact and doing it with a sense of humour, I found quite inspirational. And if people ever ask me about like mental health or addiction recovery and what books are out there, it's very rare that I would suggest one of these kind of self-help books. I mean, I should be careful because that's basically what I'm writing at the moment. But, you know, it's very rare that it'll be like one of these famous books of self-help, which work for lots of people and are great. And there's some that I really like. But the thing that I always recommend, particularly to blokes who've just got into trouble with drink or gear or whatever, and they're just down to earth blokes who can't be bothered with all the hippy dippy shit, I just say, you know, read Elton John's book or read Nile Rodgers' book, because it's just a funnier, more down to earth, more real way of like thinking about this stuff.
Well, I think what you're achieving with the podcast, The Reset, sorry, I didn't mention that. I will when I sort of top and tail this.
That's all right.
Which is really, really excellent, mate. Do you think sort of the way that you've chosen to be so open is kind of important in making the guests that you have on feel comfortable?
I guess so, but I don't know how many of them have like listened or read right, the stuff. Yeah. Some of them have. That not all of them mention it. Some of them say, oh, you know, thanks for asking me. I've looked at some of the stuff, but I'm not sure. Maybe when we start to talk, I mean, a lot of them, not so much now because I've kind of started widening the net of guests, but certainly for the first sort of 6 months or so, there were people a lot of them I already kind of knew, had some sort of relationship with, so they already felt relaxed with me. But not all of them would have known that I'd had a problem with drinking or drugs in the past. So sometimes the very fact that I was saying, come on this, I'm doing this because, by the way, I'm a recovering addict, they straight away are disarmed by that.
Right. Yeah.
Chosen to just tell them that simple fact. But I don't know how many of them know about it. But I think, yeah, you know, I try to make all of them not interviews, but conversations. And that usually is a better way of relaxing someone and disarming them into being more open, because it doesn't feel like you're putting them under any scrutiny. You're just having a conversation that works both ways. When I edit the podcast, I think, oh, fucking hell, why have I spoken so much in this? It's not about me, it's about the guest. And you know, sometimes I'm embarrassed by that. But also I think, well, that's the way it has to work. There are lots of podcasts out there where someone just interviews someone else. But for me, this is a sharing experience that goes back and forth, and that's what the listener gets out of it, you know?
Yeah. One of the things that has cropped up a couple of times as I've listened to that has been this thing you've mentioned about at a certain point swapping out talk radio news for more music for the sake of just I don't know, looking after yourself.
I mean, self-care, it's a corny phrase, but for want of a better one, I will use it and say it's something that I'm much more serious about in recent years, putting my own comfort and happiness and so forth, and the things that bring me pleasure more at the center of my life, rather than trying to squeeze them in around other shit like work, right?
Yeah.
And so obviously, but at the same time, I, you know, have responsibilities. I haven't become some sort of fucking hippie who lives off the land, or, you know, I still have to work. I still have the same responsibilities of raising children and paying the mortgage I ever had. But I just suppose my podcasting's been a massive part of that, in that I just tried to change the shape of my career and my life in order to make it a bit more relaxed, a bit more home-based. And music, and I was involved in the news and sports discussion for many years, you know, working at Talk Sport, being involved in football kind of journalism one way or another, but particularly having Talk Sport on round the clock, which I used to do. I used to live such a frantic life, always rushing from one place to another, always juggling a million different work things in my head at once. And if I was traveling by car or in an office or at home, the constant backdrop to that was Talk Sport, which is a great station, by the way. I've got nothing bad to say about it generally. I loved working there and I loved listening to it. But the thing is, there's a relentless sort of rhythm to it. And these things are all based around conflict, you know, conflicting opinion. And that's fine. It's entertaining, it's interesting, it's engaging. But it's all interspersed as well with like kind of quite aggressive, noisy, intrusive adverts. And I just got to a point where I was trying to build this life where I was at home more in the day. I was working at a pace that was more conducive to rest and happiness. I was just trying to make myself a less frantic person. And I thought having news discussion, the noise of news discussion, and the backdrop of conflict in my ears throughout the day was just not conducive to having a peaceful, less frantic mind. So I switched to music. I couldn't deal with commercial music. I'd always been quite cynical about Six Music. My wife used to listen to it and I used to take the piss because I would go, nah. Because I had this idea, which might have once been true. I have no idea. It's just one of my mad prejudices that I carried around, which was, what's that? White middle-aged bloke FM. It's all bloody Neil Young B-sides in it. It's all for blokes in plaid shirts, right? And of course, I am a white middle-aged man, but that's something again, one of my weird prejudices and delusions that I tried to pretend in my head that I'm not. And I sort of thought it was a cliche for guys who just were really into, like, I don't know, alt rock, and probably into craft beer, and, you know, really loved Neil Young, and they never fucking stopped banging on about David Bowie nonstop and never played any black artists. And, you know, generally speaking, I listen to black artists more than white, not for any prejudice, but that just happens to be my taste, sort of thing. And my wife would go, oh, it's not really like that, you know, you're just being weird. So one day in about 2018, which was when my life really started to change for the better, I'd already been sober for 3 years by then, by the way, but looking back, I just don't think I was doing sobriety right in the least until 2018. I thought I'll stick on Six Music, and I think Lauren Laverne had just taken over on Breakfast,
right? Okay.
And Marianne Hobbs, who's an old mate of mine, an old mate and colleague of mine, had taken over mid-morning, so they'd changed it all, and that straight away disarmed me a little bit, because I felt, no disrespect to any of the other hosts who you know, I love Sean Keaveney and all the other people on it as well, but suddenly it just felt like, oh, it's not just this kind of white for aging indie fan kind of station, there might be something more to it. And I just thought they were amazing, those two in particular. And I realized that the mix of music, I don't know what it once was when I had all those prejudices. I don't doubt I was almost entirely wrong about it. But, you know, suddenly I was like, fucking hell, I haven't listened to daily new music station for years. So I called myself a music fan, but everything on Spotify was just old nostalgic stuff. And then I started just making playlists as I went along every day. Whatever I heard that I liked, I just slotted in. I started a new playlist for each season. So I just started doing spring, summer, autumn, winter throughout every year and collating all these songs together that I heard. And then started looking into artists. And I had no knowledge of any new artists for years. And I started hearing some artists that I wanted to go a bit deeper into. And it's just revolutionary, just to have music on in the background, a combination of music that's quite cool, but presenters who are not particularly bothered or preoccupied with appearing cool, which is just perfect for our kind of age group. Do you know what I mean? It's like the music is cool, but these people are way beyond striking a pose or flexing about how indifferent or trendy they are. They're just like pretty, it's kind of like Lauren Laverne, such a great broadcaster. She's happy to just be a kind of a mum next door, but simultaneously just having this immense passion for music that is really intoxicating. Broadcasters who are really authentically passionate about what they speak about are absolutely wonderful. And I think that's why I really fell in love with Six Music and in turn reopened my mind to just being curious about new music again. And it genuinely sounds overblown, but I know that you'll agree, as a man of music, genuinely life-changing. One of the biggest things I ever did for my mental health.
That's great. Well, to be honest, a lot of people that work playing music are often the worst at consuming it for enjoyment. And
right,
I've been through periods of that, and it's something that I try to avoid. I think some people will go, oh, you know, I've played music all night, especially gigging musicians. They go, oh, just...
Last thing I want, yeah.
But, there's a whole universe of music, so you didn't play the whole universe of music that night. That's what I always kind of think.
I see it as food. Food is there are a few things that are like reliably the source of kind of comfort and joy in life, right? Food's one of them, right? I'm not like a food-aholic or anything, but food, when you perceive it just as this great sort of source of pleasure that nourishes you as well, is wonderful. So saying you're not into music to me is saying I'm not really into food in some ways. I mean, you could say, oh, well, yeah, but you won't die if you stop listening to music. But part of you does, because, you know, this is in a way that I'm not sort of quite eloquent or insightful enough to articulate. I really do think that, you know, music does enrich your soul, and it transports you away from all of the bullshit kind of little problems and anxieties that, you know, create problems for you, or sadness or whatever every day. It transports you away from that. Songs give you feelings that feel more universal, more perennial, remind you that the universe is something much bigger than your trifling little day-to-day problems with its bills or its, you know, fucking DIY issues or whatever else it is. And it just elevates you onto a different plane. It reminds you, like great books do, that there are some human conditions and reflections and emotional stories that are just timeless. So you'll hear someone singing a song from the 1950s that almost perfectly sums up the way you feel about something in 2022. And that's amazing. And, I always go back to what George Michael said, one of my all-time favourite artists, George Michael, when he sang, you've got to have some faith in the sound. It's the one good thing that we've got. I always think of that line because I think, yeah, he meant that. It does sound like a corny lyric he's thrown together, but he's like, listen, what one good thing have you always got that's always there for you? A fucking record that you can just put on and know what else is going on. That is, you know, you will find somewhere on Spotify or in your record collection a sound that makes you feel better.
I've spent some of my sort of working life so far in the bizarre situation of being in some establishments where you kind of have to argue the importance of pop music compared to, say, classical music or other forms of art music. Mm. And I always think about George Michael as one of these examples of someone who was a complete genius. It's not just that he was a great singer. He was a brilliant artist. And think about where he... I know I've heard you speak about this before, but think about where he came from. He wasn't from a kind of traditional classical music background, but he just had this... music seemed to pour out of him with a purity. He listened to that voice. It's incredible. And just his way of distilling either something that he thought of culturally or then later on in his career, something that was going on in his life. And turning that into a great piece of pop music that was universal.
Let me ask you
fun.
Something. Like, you write and create music. I had about half a dozen or a dozen saxophone lessons when I was about 11.
Oh, really?
And I was useless. Oh, great. I was useless. I gave up. So I've not got that. That's the full extent of my musical know-how, right? So it's a great mystery to me, like how any of these people operate and how it happens. As someone who's always written for a living, I know that some days, especially when I'm in a bit of a flow, if I need to write something, sometimes quite quickly, that's going to be funny or compelling, I will sometimes hit a day, and it doesn't come regularly, but sometimes I will just get into a flow where I can just sit down and go straight into first draft. And it seems like as easy as pie to convey exactly what needs to be conveyed in a way that I know. Without being arrogant, I think I know that's funny, I know that's compelling, I know it does the job. And sometimes, you know, in the past, when every day I was writing and sending stuff off to editors to be published in newspapers or magazines, I would sometimes just instinctively know, well, that's going to sail through. I can go out now because there's no way the editor's going to come back with any changes on that. I know.
Right, yeah.
And I sometimes think about someone like George Michael, and I think, does it work the same way with music and songwriting? Can you sit down at the piano or with the guitar, and some days a melody can just come out that is just, that's just it.
I think there's levels of it, mate, because as part of the reason that I fell into academia, and as well as being a performer, I mean, you know, I've kind of done stuff for you, you know that I write and play, but I would say the extent of my writing and playing is I'm kind of a hack.
Right.
Which means doing stuff like the stuff I've done for you guys is...
Well, I've always given you a brief, and if I give you a brief, it comes back almost amazingly quickly and exactly right straight away. Like, I go, I'll make it a little bit like when you made the jingles for my Top Flight TFTM Turbo little radio shows that we do. And I said, I'll do one, Don't Fear Love, that's like an 80s soul smooth classic. And you were just like, bang. And it came back and it was like, oh, I could have asked Alexander O'Neill and he wouldn't have done it as well.
Well, I think it's quite fortunate that we probably have some of the same taste in that sort of thing. Because I was like, I think I know what this needs to be. But so there's a level of confidence that you can have with that sort of thing. So I guess a lot of what I've done in academia is driven towards that. It's kind of deconstructing, breaking things down. It makes me quite useful... has made me quite useful as a teacher and a lecturer, because I'm quite good at pulling things apart. So in terms of delivering on a brief, that's really useful.
Yeah.
But then there's other people that I think are the people that lead trends, who are just way out in front of that. And I think they are plugged into something deeper.
So that's the genius. That's when it's genius level, is when they create stuff out of nowhere.
I think so. That's the magic thing. And it's the heaviest name I've got to drop. I was speaking to Graham Goldman last week from 10cc, and he's one of these guys that's had hits from the mid 60s right the way through. You know, he wrote I'm Not in Love and all of these genius things. And he was talking about when he's having a good day, it just comes to him and he follows it through.
Yeah.
That was the terminology he used. He just follows the song.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've never really experienced that thing of inspiration, but that's the difference between someone that's a great songwriter and someone that's quite good at working out what all the pieces can be and build it up.
So I know you wanted to get onto this anyway, but I'm going to bring it.
No, do it, please, mate.
Now it's in my mind. So what did you think, as someone with your background and your ability to understand and sort of see songs in an academic way, What did you think about watching the way in which Lennon and McCartney wrote together in Get Back?
It's mind blowing.
Yeah. They're standing just face to face making this shit up. Is that something that you'd seen done before? Is that, you know, you obviously knew about the Beatles, but did you predict that it would be that way before you saw it?
I know that people do that. And, you know, it's kind of like a Nashville thing. You get writers in a room. There's certain types of songwriters that have kind of learned to do that thing of a co-writing thing. But obviously, Lennon and McCartney are different because everything in pop music comes from Lennon and McCartney, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
There's the period beforehand in rock and roll, but then...
Yeah.
They're the kind of nexus of everything that comes after. And I think everyone that loves the Beatles has this romantic idea of them with the two chairs sat in the kitchen like they always said they did. And you go, I wonder if it ever really was like that. And the beautiful thing about Get Back is that it shows you that, yeah, it was that intensity when they're both there together. And they're, and the kind of clear respect and admiration they have for one another as well.
Yeah, that's so sweet, isn't it? The way they find each other funny.
Yeah.
And even when one of them's being weird, like Paul McCartney's being a little bit Lampard-y at times, almost like trying to gee them all up and corral them into, and like John just is sort of like cool with it because he's just like, it's just what he's like. It's nice to see all that
stuff.
It's
just beautiful,
isn't it?
Paul,
even when he's uptight and John's doing that thing of he won't take anything seriously, and Paul takes loads of stuff seriously, and Paul will be saying like, we got to get our heads up, we got to get this sorted, I'm really worried. And John will just say something juvenile, and Paul's perfectly willing to just collapse into fits of laughter at that. And that must have been one of the secrets to it all, mustn't it, to the magic, is that sort of like that love that they had for each other.
Yeah, it's really palpable. And I think that the beautiful gift that documentary gives us all is just blowing so many of those traditional old tropes and narratives about, you know, what the end of the Beatles was like. It's just all kind of been blown out of
the
water by, hasn't it?
But in terms of like the history of songwriting, and you say, oh, everything came from them, which is something that, you know, is something that I agree with, I guess, but I don't really know about the history of songwriting. But I'm not convinced they would agree with that. I'm not convinced that Lennon and McCartney would agree with that. Because if you see them writing, they're obsessed with mainly old classic rock and roll, I guess, and bits of blues. And they even talk about jazz at one point. And so what they are is they were like devotees, almost fanboys of black American music.
Sure, yeah.
And they saw themselves as just doing their own kind of almost watered down white Liverpudlian tributes to that stuff, which sounds really mean, but I think that's how they saw themselves. So what did they bring to it beyond being, I mean, this might be a contentious thing to say, but beyond, and you know from listening to my podcast that I am a huge Beatles fan. I'm a devotee of the Beatles, so I don't wish to undermine them. But I just think they would see themselves as like, well, no, we're just paying tribute to these black American artists that we grew up loving, right? I mean, what did they bring to it? Apart from the fact that, of course, they were white, which maybe made it more commercial.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I made a sweeping statement to everything. I think in terms of their place in the history of pop music, there's a time pre-Beatles and there's a time post-Beatles.
But yeah.
In terms of the writing, I've quite often talked with students about this. There's a traditional narrative with the Beatles that they were a rock and roll covers band, and then their development in terms of their experimentalism with music was linear. But there's all kinds of things that you can find, whether it's the chord progressions they use or the way that they mess around with structure, that they were doing right from 62 that was quite subversive in the context of the time.
And that was different to anything that had even done by the artists that influenced them.
Well, yeah. And so even some of the things that we go, quite often people go, oh, you know, it's like a traditional, well, kind of lazy people talking about pop music say, it's like a traditional Beatles pop song, you know. Well, there isn't really any such thing, because there's very few early Beatles songs that you can find that do that thing of go verse, chorus, middle A, two choruses and you're out. Actually, that's kind of it's very rare that it happens. I mean, even things like She Loves You, that's got a really subversive...
They wasn't a big thing. They started straight into the chorus.
In some cases, yeah. But even things like, you know, that's, you know, If I Fell. The intro of that kind of does this sort of jazz chord progression type thing, but it's not quite a jazz thing. It's their own unique thing, and it's not like... There wasn't the time in their work to develop at the rate that they did.
Yeah.
I guess the other thing that always strikes me about them, which isn't really about them, is George Martin. I mean, I think I saw it via your Twitter actually. That video of George Martin talking to his granddaughter.
Oh yeah, it's so beautiful, isn't it?
It really is beautiful, and I just think that moment he's describing. He had no right to know what he was doing in that moment.
Yeah.
And he really didn't need to sign them.
No, but he just said they were nice guys, yeah, didn't he?
No,
there's a lesson to be learned about life there as well, isn't there, really? Because nowadays, in business or in any endeavour that I've ever worked in, people try to play down the role of humans because humans are temporary and unreliable and inconsistent. So you can only really get an idea off the ground if you've got some sort of tedious dry data or mechanism that drives it, and it's not dependent on any particular individual. And there's something a little bit depressing about that, but something that lots of us have just accepted in whatever work we do. And to hear someone just go, not even something overblown and highfalutin, like, I knew they were geniuses and I knew that they could harness the cosmos to sort of interpret, you know, the messages being sent from beyond, right? It's nothing like that. I just said, I thought they were really nice. And usually if someone's nice and quite intelligent, then they've got a better chance. A, it's going to be nicer to work with them, better experience, but also just those two qualities give them a better chance of producing something good. And you sort of think it's a simple thing, and it's something that, I don't know, perhaps we're losing sight of a bit in whatever you do for a living. I'm sure it's the same in your industry. It's been the same in many of the industries I've worked in. And it's maybe just same in life for the people that you spend time with, you know, not thinking about it in terms of what, in a cynical kind of, what will I get out of this? More like they seem nice and intelligent. I'll probably make my decision on the basis that it'll be more pleasant spending time with them than some other dickhead.
It's brilliant. And I can't think of a better way for us to wrap that up, really, mate. Sam, I've really enjoyed chatting about music with you. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's an absolute pleasure, mate. Love to talk about music anytime, and best of luck with the pod. And thank you for all the amazing musical output that you've created for Top Flight Time Machine, which a lot of which we played on our live shows as well. We really appreciate all of that, Alex, and you've been a really important part of our little creative family that we've built.
Oh, I appreciate it, mate. Thanks a lot.
Massive thanks to Sam for coming on and chatting music with me. I'm a fan of his, so it was really cool to get together and talk. Next time, I'll be speaking to star of stage and screen, Will Haswell, about Back to the Future and a bunch of other stuff. So check it out. Until then, see you later. Bye-bye.